In 1968, I was in a meeting in Statesville, North Carolina, and during the course of the meeting, I was preparing one afternoon for the lesson of the evening. And staying in the home of this Christian family, I was in my bedroom, lying on the bed, studying. And there was this pesky fly who kept buzzing around and lighting on my nose and lighting in my ear and on my eyes, and he'd light on the paper and light on the book, and I just couldn't do anything but contend with that fly. And finally, he stopped long enough, and I eased up behind him and just knocked him into the next kingdom, and he landed over there in a spider web. And when he came to, he started buzzing and carrying on and carrying like that, and all that did was call up Mr. Spider. And he came up, and you could almost see him look around and say, "Well, what have we here?" And I watched carefully because I thought something real good was going to happen, and sure enough, it did. This fly, being caught in the web, he couldn't get out. The spider came up, and I watched him wrap part of that web around one of his legs, and then he walked around the fly and got another leg of the fly and wrapped another part of the web around him and walked around him again and tied down a third leg. And then I watched, and he walked right over the fly's stomach. He wasn't afraid anymore, walked right over his stomach, and the fly was a lot bigger than this spider, and tied down a fourth leg, and then went back and rested and got ready for supper that night. And I thought, well, that's the most amazing thing I've ever seen. I got up from the bed and went into the living room, and Earl Nightingale's program was on the radio at that time. I turned it on just by chance. And in the course of Mr. Nightingale's program, he said, "Were it not for the fly's natural enemies, the fly would, within 12 months' time, multiply to the extent that he would cover the earth to the depth of 6 feet all over the earth." Now, that's a lot of flies. And it's a big job for those who are the enemies of the fly. But they do a pretty good job. And if you'll just look around, you'll see what a good job those enemies of the fly really do. I believe today that the earth is facing a similar threat to what the earth faces at the hands of the fly. I believe that morally speaking, we're being inundated by the forces of evil. I believe that perhaps as no other time in history, we're being threatened by the forces of evil to the point that they're about to overcome us. In the book of Revelation, John pictures a time when he says that the forces of evil, the forces of Satan, are going to come up across the breadth of the whole earth, and they will encompass the whole city, the holy city. And he describes that period of time, and I think he's talking about now. I believe he's talking about the time when the forces of evil at this present hour are making a very serious, concerted effort to inundate and absolutely deluge the forces of right that are on the earth today. Environmentally, we've been warned and we've been notified and made aware of the fact that we're destroying the earth that we live on. And the government has taken steps to see that that stops. And we ought to stop it. We ought not to be litter bugs. We ought not to confuse the earth with our litter and our trash and the things that are cluttering the earth up. We ought not to defile our streams. These things are legitimate concerns. But I'm also aware of the fact that as concerned as the government is about the pollution in the environmental stage or the environmental aspect of our universe, they're not very concerned about other polluting in the moral or religious or ethical realm. We're being inundated today educationally. We're being inundated by atheism educationally. Those who do not believe in God have taken over the upper echelons of the training of our teachers. Now, the universities in America today are being governed, and the educational processes that are being taught are being based upon the assumption that there is no God. And consequently, those teachers who are coming out of those universities and are being placed in our public school system are, to a great degree, teaching those philosophies that are denying the existence of God. We find that there is a concerted effort to destroy the difference between right and wrong.
And they're saying today that there is no such thing as a standard. There's no such thing as right or wrong. That's a normal, that's a common approach to morality today that's being taught in our schools. Also, our textbooks in our public school system are being riddled with obscenities, four-letter words. We just simply cannot depend upon our children being taught things that will make them noble. They're being taught that they're just animals and nothing more than an animal. And since there's no difference between right and wrong, they're beginning to act like animals without any conscience for what's right or without any conscience for what's wrong. Communicationally, not only educationally, but communicationally, in the sense of TV and in the sense of magazines, we're being bombarded on every hand. Television is becoming unfit to watch. Soap, which at one time indicated something clean or a cleansing agent, is today looked upon as not a cleansing agent, but an agent of filth. And that's a television program that much attention has been brought to, but not enough. We need to be aware of the fact that we're being bombarded by television. We see sadism, we see pornography, we see bestiality in magazines that are produced and sold over the newsstands. And our children are being confronted with this kind of an attack upon their moral values and their moral standards. And we're living in a generation, we're living in a nation, we're living in an age when everything that we hold dear is being threatened and is being brought under attack. We need to open our eyes to the fact that we're under the attack of an evil force, and we'd better do something about it. I'm asking, is there no force that God has intended to oppose such immorality and such godlessness? Well, I believe that God has placed a force on earth. I believe He's placed law, for one thing, but I also believe that He's placed as a positive force Christian people. When Jesus said in Matthew the 5th chapter, "You are the salt of the earth," I think He was talking about the ability to arrest the decay of a morally degenerate earth. When He said, "You're the light of the world," I believe that He was offering an option to the world of darkness that we see so rampant around us. I believe that He has placed you and me as Christians to take this job of morally arresting the deterioration of the world. I think it's our task to take that and do something about it, as salt and as light. Now, in the Ephesian letter, we're told how the salt and the light is to work. If you want to be turning in your Bibles to Ephesians, we're going to be working out of there this morning. Ephesians, the 6th chapter, the first verses 10 through 13, describes in detail how the Christian is to work as salt and light. The effect will be to the degree that these methods are implemented. Finally, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of His might. We've just sung about it just now. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we're not contending against flesh and blood, but against the principalities, against the powers, against the world rulers of this present darkness, against the spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore, take the whole armor of God that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. John reminds us in 1 John chapter 3 and verse 8, the reason the Son of God appeared was to destroy the works of the devil. John says that's why Jesus came. It was to destroy the works of the devil. If that was Jesus' work, and we are followers of Jesus, then it naturally follows that that's our work too, to destroy the works of the devil. Jesus did not do it in a placid way. He did not do it in a way that was, he just simply took a positive course and carried out His plan. He wants us to take a positive course also. His wasn't a violent course, but it was definitely a positive course for a positive solution. And He wants us to do the same thing. How would you like to join Jesus Christ in His work? Now that sounds odd to ask Christian people how they would like to join Jesus Christ in His work. But that's exactly what I'm asking, because that's the question we need to answer. And I'll tell you, the time that we have to answer the question is not all that great. I believe that right now our backs are up against the wall. I don't think we have much of an option. I believe that we either let it be known where we stand as Christians, or else the world is going to literally steamroller us over. They're going to destroy us. They're going to literally root us out of existence if we don't take our stand. How many of you, and I'm not asking you to show your hands, but How many of you would like to become real serious about being salt? Real serious about being light? Real serious about weaving a web to combat the godlessness that's threatening our very moral standards around us today? How many of you would be willing to get real serious about this kind of work and accomplish the work of the Lord? Well, you say, what's involved in it? Well, there are just about two things involved. One of them is this. There needs to be a transformation in our own lives. We can't begin to stop the tide of evil until there's a transformation in the life of the Christians who are opposing evil. You need not try to do it artificially. You need not try to artificially summons in your own life concern over things about which you're not concerned. I've observed that people who are unconcerned about sin in their own lives are usually unconcerned about sin around about them. I've observed that a person who will not see to it that sin is rooted out of his own life will not be very concerned about it being rooted out of the community round about him. I believe that a person that stands up to fight sin ought to first be a part of the transformation that Jesus Christ brings into the lives of people who follow him. I'm convinced that reformation, or that opposing evil, begins in a transformed life. Reformation of society, or the opposing of evil, begins in a transformed life. Paul, in the Roman letter, makes the statement, I appeal to you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship, or your reasonable service. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that you may prove what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. Paul talks about this transformation. He says, don't be conformed to the world. Be transformed by the renewal of your mind. Simon Peter, in the second letter that he wrote, talked about our escaping from the corruption that's in the world through lust and becoming partakers of the divine nature. But he talked about it as a twofold thing, as a twofold process. Escaping the corruption that's in the world through lust and becoming partakers of the divine nature. And you can't do one without doing the other. And you're not going to be very concerned about the sin around you unless you're concerned about the sin within you. That follows, and it's not all that much to make that deduction. You know, you've got to be a spider to spin a spider web. You can't spin a spider web. You're not a spider. And I don't care how hard you may try, the little tiny sub-hair breadth web, you couldn't work with that. It takes a spider to work with that. He works with it without even thinking about it. He works with it from the time of his very youth until the time that he dies. But you can't do it. You've got to be a spider to spin a spider web. I'm convinced that you've also got to have experienced the new birth before you can experience the new life. I'm convinced that you've got to experience the transformation before you'll ever experience any real involvement in getting sin rooted out of the world. I don't think you can do it artificially. You know, you can give a caterpillar 1,000 lessons, but you'll never teach him how to fly. Never. I don't care how detailed you may get. I don't care how patient you may be. You'll never get a caterpillar to fly. In fact, he'll be very, very afraid of it. You heard about the caterpillar that was talking to another and punched him when he saw a butterfly go by, and he said, you'll never get me up in one of those things. And that's exactly the way he feels, scared to death about it. But you know what you need to do? Just wait a few minutes or wait a few weeks, and the caterpillar will by nature become a butterfly, and then he just soars and flies wherever he wants to, because it happens by natural process. It's going to be people who also have been born anew, who have been transformed by this renewing of their minds, that will be the ones involved in rooting out sin wherever they find it. Look at 1 Peter, if you will, real quickly. 1 Peter, the first and second chapters. Simon Peter, in the first chapter, describes some people, and in the second chapter, he gives them some instructions. But it was the people that he describes in chapter 1, verses 22 and 23, to whom he gives the instructions in chapter 2, verse 9. It was these people, notice, seeing that you have purified your souls by your obedience to the truth unto sincere love of the brethren, love one another sincerely or earnestly from the heart. You've been born anew, not of perishable seed, but of imperishable, through the living and abiding word of God. It's these people who had come out of sin through their obedience to the truth. They had purified their souls. They had been born anew by this imperishable seed. It's these people to whom Simon Peter addresses the statement in verse 9 of chapter 2. But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's own people, that you may declare the wonderful deeds of Him who called you out of darkness into His marvelous light. These people had been born anew. They had purified their souls through obedience to the truth. They had come out of darkness into God's marvelous light. And it is these people that Simon Peter then gave this instruction, that they ought to be aware of the fact that they are a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a peculiar people, that they might declare the wonderful deeds of Him that had called them. So we find that there was a qualifying that had to take place in their lives before they were ready to do the job of proclaiming the wonderful things that God had done. And in the Ephesian letter, again, back up into Ephesians, and let's look there just for a moment. The one qualification for battle here that Paul talks about with these Christians is that they put on the armor. You don't go into battle without putting on the armor. And he says here, put on the whole armor of God so that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we're not contending against flesh and blood, but against the principalities, against the powers, against the world, rulers of this present darkness, against the spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore, take the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, and I think that simply means having done all this preparation, having gotten all of this on, then you stand. And consequently, he simply says that one of the things essential to routing evil, to overcoming evil, is first of all, get your own life in order. There must be a transformation in your life. Now let me give you some specifics in this. Turn, if you will, right back one page to Ephesians, the fourth chapter. And Paul here gives some specific details as to what is involved in cleaning up our lives. He lists seven negative things and seven positive things. Seven negative instructions, seven positive instructions. Each negative has a corresponding positive. In fact, if you'll think real closely, I'll venture to say that you've never read a place in all the Bible where God ever told you to stop doing something evil that He did not say you ought to start doing something good in its place. He always replaces evil with good. Now, you find any place where God did not do that, and I'll eat my hat. He's told us always to quit doing one thing, but He'll tell us to start doing something else in its place. That's what He's done here. I'm not going to go into detail in these seven things, but just enough to comment so that you'll know exactly what it's talking about. In verses 24, beginning verses 24 through 32, and then one or two places in chapter 5, he mentions these seven things. Put off lying. And he puts it in these terms, put off and put on. Put off the old man, put on the new man. One of the things, first of all, he says put off lying. That's verse 24. He says, in the place of it, put on the speaking of truth. Now, that involves everything from lying on a test, which cheating is what is. That's what lying on a test is. It's cheating. Or lying on your income tax. That's cheating. Or lying again. So those who cheat and those who misrepresent their income tax, these are people who are liars. He says here, you mustn't do that, but speak the truth. Now, let me go before we go any further. I want you to look at verses 5 and 6 of chapter 5. If you think this is something that can be taken or left, then you need to look at it again. Paul is saying something here that is absolutely essential. In fact, he says something here, and he underlines it in such strong terms that you cannot miss the message. The people who indulge in these things that we're going to be talking about are going to go to hell. That's all you can say about it. Listen to what he says in verse 5. Be sure of this. And there's a good strong statement. Be sure of this, that no immoral or impure man or one who is covetous, that is an idolater, has any inheritance in the kingdom of God, a kingdom of Christ and of God. Then he says again, verse 6, let no one deceive you with empty words, for it is because of these things that the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. Don't let anybody deceive you, and you can be sure of this, that those who practice these things are not going to have any part in the kingdom of God. Now, that's strong enough to get our attention. These seven things that he's talking about are these. Number one, lying. In its place, you put speaking the truth. Number two, anger. He says, don't be angry to the point of sin. And then in its place, he says, forgive quickly. When you get angry at someone, don't you hold on to that anger past when the sun goes down. That's a real simple explanation of the extent of anger. Don't let it last more than a day. Don't carry any grudges. And he just simply says that to carry a grudge is to live like the world lives. But don't do that. Don't be angry past the point of sin or to the point of sin, and you must forgive quickly. But a third thing that he says in verse 28, you've got to give up theft. You've got to give up theft. You can't go on stealing. Do you know what he's talking about in particular? Let me translate it into 1977 Searcy. It means shoplifting. Last Friday's Searcy Citizen had as the headline article that shoplifting was such a problem in Searcy that it needed to be brought out into the open. Just last week or the week before, it had been brought to the attention of the officials of the college that enough college students were involved in shoplifting in Searcy that something ought to be done about it. They are a reproach to the school. They are a reproach to this church or wherever they are. They are a reproach to the Lord. Shoplifting is this thing of theft. That's exactly what he's talking about. And I cannot believe that the 5% of the people who are not members of the church on campus are the 5% who are doing the stealing. I believe it's those people, and there's a lot of them, who, though they are members of the church, never have become Christians. There never has been a transformation or a reformation in their life, and consequently, they're living like the devil lives. And they're stealing. They're guilty of theft, the text says here, that we must not be guilty of. We must not even have these things named among us as becoming a Christian. Something else. It means paying your debts. To give up theft means that you pay your debts. To be a thief means that you just simply ignore your debts. Are any of you ignoring your debts? Are there people in this community or other communities that can point to you and say, this man doesn't pay his debts? Let me tell you something. To live a life and to be irresponsible and to blindly go away ignoring your debts is to sign yourself away to hell. You can't go to heaven as a thief. You can't shoplift. You can't be irresponsible of your debts. You've got to pay your debts. That's what he's talking about here. You must give up debts. You must give up theft. And then he said, secondly, in the place of your theft, do honest work. That's verse 28b. But look again, he says, evil talk. That's verse 29. In the place of evil talk, he said, you ought to give such language or use such language that edifies and that gives thanks to God. Evil talk. What kind of talk is that? Well, it's any kind of filthy language, dirty jokes, cursing, swearing, or whatever it may be that would indicate that you condone those things. Jerome Barnes, in an effort to clean up a film, and every film that comes on this campus just about has to be cleaned up. You can't look at films anymore unless Walt Disney put them out and expect to be able to look at them as a family or as a Christian. And Jerome Barnes, bless his heart, in an attempt to clean up one of the films that came on campus, was more or less ridiculed in the Bison 2 weeks ago with tongue in cheek and with ridicule pointing at him as being a narrow-minded bigot who would dare think about censoring something that came on the campus. Or he was talking about perhaps Billy Ray Cox, who got up in chapel and spoke out against this television program, Soap. Young people, what's happening to us whenever we cannot even stand up and for the right say we need to avoid these things? What happens when people in chapel then boo this Billy Ray Cox because of his stand against the program Soap? Something's happening to your mind. The mind of Christ is slipping away from us if that's the way that we react to a person trying to stand up for what's right. Look again. He says evil talk, then bitterness and malice. He says put that away and be kind to one another and tender. Put away immorality. Sexual immorality is what it's referring to. And be godlike. That's verse 1. And then it says put away drunkenness in chapter 5 and verse 18. And be filled with the Spirit. So you find these seven things he wants you to put off. Lying, anger, theft, evil talk, bitterness, immorality, and drunkenness. And in the place of it, speak the truth, forgive quickly, do honest work, edify, be kind, be godlike, and be filled with the Spirit. So the first thing that he says, would you combat the evil that's in the world? Then he says, first of all, you must combat the evil that is in yourself. We must put off the old nature and put on the new nature, because you're not qualified to do anything in combating evil outside you until you have, first of all, met with it on your own self on the inside. There's where you must begin. But the second thing that he says is oppose it wherever you find it then after that. You oppose it inside, fair enough. Oppose it outside. And once you've cleared up the inside, and this doesn't mean that you have to be perfect, but it does mean that you must have made a mark so that people will know whose side you're on. And you've got to make a mark in the sense that people know you're trying. They know you're not perfect, certainly, but they've got to know that you're trying to do the will of the Lord. And once you've made that clear to the world and to the church, then you're equipped and ready to make this battle outside yourself. But somebody says, I'm just one person. What on earth can I do? I wonder if that spider thought of that when that fly flew into his web. Surely he didn't say, I'm just one spider. Man, I never will make it. Man, this whole world is going to be overcome by 6 feet of flies, and I just can't do it. What good is that one fly going to do if I kill him? Let me go over and let him loose. I'll just let him go on. I'll ignore it. Why, of course not. And neither should that be the attitude that we have toward evil. And I'll confess that I'm one of the first. And one of the reasons why I'm preaching this sermon is because I need to kick myself in the seat. I need to get up off the floor and do something about some things that I've just been letting fly by and ride by. And I need for you to say to me every once in a while, okay, preacher, what have you done lately to dispel evil? What have you done lately to uproot evil? Make me answer, because I'm going to be poking you and making you answer, and you get poked every time I get up here. It's your time to poke. Poke at me and say, what are you doing? Are you taking care of any of these flies? Well, you say, what can I do? Let me give you some suggestions. A recent convert just in the last 2 or 3 weeks after his conversion took off a whole week from his work, took a week's vacation so he could study the Bible. He sounds like some kind of a fanatic. No, he's just a dedicated Christian. He wants to follow the Lord. And he took off this week work so that he could go home and get his Bible down and get some good books, and he's going to find out what this thing's all about. That's what happened when he became a Christian. Let me ask you to follow his example. Can't we find a time each day in our lives as Christians, a quiet time where we get the Word and get our mind in tune with the will of God? Can't we do that? I'll tell you, you're not going to be in any shape to combat evil on the outside until you keep up your spiritual defenses on the inside. You've got to have this inside, or else you can't do the work outside. Let me give you another example. Jimmy Carr has a habit. He's always going around picking up paper. Everywhere he goes, he must be a pack rat. I see him just picking up this and picking up that and junk, and you'd be surprised at all the stuff he picks up. But I watched him one day, and he puts it in a garbage can. He's an anti-litter nut, and the whole campus is cleaner because Jimmy Carr lives there. That's right. He not only doesn't throw it down, but he picks up after some of us. Would you follow his example? If you will, then we'll make this campus and make this city a cleaner place to live. But if you won't, then don't criticize the people who dump garbage and stuff in the cities, from the cities into the streams. They're no worse off than we are. It's just in a greater scale, just a larger scale. Follow his example. But you're just one person. What else can you do? Well, look at Ben Berry. What can I do about pornography? We're just one person. We're just one man. We're one woman. Is there anything I can do about it? Yes, there's something you can do. Neil Gallagher came to the campus during our lectureship, and as one man, took upon himself to start a one-man campaign against pornography in America. He was then brought here to this campus, and during the lectureship, we heard him speak. Ben Berry heard him speak. But Ben's only one man. That's right, but he is one man. And he went down to DeQueen and went to one of the big retail stores there and looked on the shelf, and sure enough, they were selling pornography. Blatant, raw, bloody pornography. And he just took it and bought some of it and told the lady, look, lady, I want you to understand, I'm not buying this to read. I'm buying it to get rid of it. And he went and took it to the person that owned it. He knew the man that owned the store. And he went to him and knew that he was a God-fearer. And he said, look, do you realize what you're selling down there? And he showed him this book on pornography and said, this is what you're selling in your store. And then he read him from Timothy, where Paul told Timothy, God did not give us a spirit of timidity and fear, but of love and of power and self-control. And then he asked the man, would he pray with him about it? Ben Berry asked that man to pray. They knelt in prayer and asked God to give them the strength to get rid of this. And so the man got up off his knees, went down to the store that he owned, told the manager, I want this out of here. And sure enough, from what I hear, that's what's going to be done. Well, there were some young boys that also followed that example. They went here to some of the stores in Searcy and said the same thing. Do you realize what you're selling? And the lady, after looking through what she was selling, was encouraged by these boys. Get it off the shelf. It's not fit to sell. And as Ben told this man, you wouldn't sell this kind of food if it was polluted. You wouldn't think about selling it. Why sell this stuff that'll pollute the mind? And he tried not to preach, but he said, I almost got to preaching. And it's time to do something. It's time to start preaching. And if every one of us, every time we went into a store that sold such filth as that, would go to the manager and say, do you realize what you're selling here? It wouldn't be long before they'd quit selling it. We're going to have to do that. We need to follow that good example. Look at Ed Murray. Ed Murray, one of the members of this body, about 12 years ago, before it was really fashionable to say anything, and before some people even recognized that it was a problem, objected to some of the textbooks that his children were being exposed to. He called up the teacher and said, what is the problem? He said, why is it that my child is being exposed to such filth as this? And she tried to explain how the children at the 6th and 7th grade need to be made aware of what's in the world. Rubbish, They're going to get aware of it well enough without our putting our stamp of approval upon it. And so finally, he made this objection and just simply says, I will not tolerate it. I won't have it. And he said, I didn't realize it, but I was only one out of many. There were a lot of other ones who went to the school board. Finally, it came about that there was an editorial in the paper. Then out of that editorial came an action that simply took that school book out of the school, put another textbook in its place. And as a result, that one man had an influence for good in cleaning up some of the corruption that's in the world. We've got other people, Marilyn Kreitling. She and her husband have just moved into town. They're members of this congregation. And she's been fighting in the years past this textbook problem. And as a result, now she and her husband have come here after doing what they could do where they were. And now they want to see if they can't do something here and help us do something. In fact, she's going to be telling Thursday night at 7:30 what is this very subtle and yet blatant way in which people are going about infiltrating our textbooks that our children are being taught from, and how that it's corrupting the minds of these young people to where they're being ripped off by the dozens every day. She's going to be talking about that Thursday night. What can you do about it? You say, I don't have any children. Well, probably your interest won't be as great as if you did have children, but those who have children ought to be over there to hear what's being said. And those of you who are students, you ought to go over there and hear what's being said Thursday night at 7:30. That's what you can do. And next week we're going to be talking about some more things that have to do with the corruption that's around about us. And I want to make a confession. Is it in order for the preacher to make a confession? I've made enough of them. I guess maybe you get tired of hearing them. But I've got problems too. I want to make a confession. I have run from things like this and stuck my head in the sand until I'm afraid I'm going to be responsible for a part of the corruption that's in the world tonight. And I want to do something about it. And I'm tired of running. And we're going to be discussing today and next Sunday morning and the next Sunday morning some of the things that may help us stand up and let it be heard. All right, these are some of the things that we need to be aware of. And you can do something. First of all, clean up yourself, get yourself cleaned up, not perfect, but set your mind on where you're going, and then do what you can where you are to clean up the corruption round about you. Turn, if you will, to Romans, the 13th chapter, and let me leave this with you as a text to think on. Beginning in verse 11 of chapter 13, besides this, you know what hour it is. You know what time it is. How it is full time now for you to awake out of sleep. For salvation is nearer to us now than when we first believed. The night is far gone. The day is at hand. Let us cast off the works of darkness and put on the armor of light. Let us conduct ourselves becomingly as in the day, not in reveling and drunkenness, not in debauchery and licentiousness, not in quarreling and jealousy, but put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh to gratify its desires. I think he's sounding a warning here. He's sounding an alarm. He says, you know what time it is. It's high time you awoke out of sleep. It's high time we did something about it. And I'm confident that the elders of this congregation will back you in whatever you do. That's lawful and legal, and it's the same thing, but that is within the bounds of Christian principles. But I'm confident that they're going to back you in opposing evil wherever you find it. They already have. After the first service, some of the elders came up and said, preach on. We've got to have it. And so we do. We've got a mindset that's not conducive to it, though. We're so anxious to be approved and accepted by the world that we have forgotten what it means to be rejected by the world. But Jesus conditioned his disciples to be rejected by the world. Why? Because the things that they were going to be doing were going to fly right in the face of the world. And if we're not being opposed by the world, it's pretty good proof that we're not doing anything in opposition to the world. And we need to wake up and get at it. You want to do something for the Lord? You want to get involved with the work of the Lord? Well, here's part of his work. It's not all of it, but it's part of it. He came to destroy the works of Satan. And if you want to do part of the work of the Lord, then you're going to have to get involved in it. We'll talk more about it next week in detail. Would you like to be a Christian? You say, well, not if it involves all that. Okay, then let's talk to somebody else. Would you like to be a Christian? Well, you mean I have to get involved in all that? Yeah, you have to be involved in a transformation of your life. And you have to be involved in fighting evil wherever you find it, speaking out against it. We'll talk about it in detail, but that is involved part of it. If you want to be a Christian, come in faith, repent of your sins, turn your back upon them, be immersed in water for the forgiveness of those sins. He'll raise you to a walk of holiness, to a life of godliness, and it involves fighting evil wherever you find it. If you'd like to become a Christian, or if you're here and you are a Christian, may I say this, put on the armor, get ready for the fight, because it's coming, whether you like it or not. And you're either going to have to run or stick your head in the sand or stand up and fight, because it's on us. Let's stand and sing this song, Stand Up, Stand Up for Jesus.